The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to our first books podcast of 2015. Do you feel you have just too much stuff in your life? Are you minded to declutter as well as detox? We'll have more about all that later on in this podcast. But first, there are always more books on the horizon demanding a place in your minds and on your shelves. So to help you find a way through, we've assembled a crack panel of experts to give their tips for the reading year ahead. Warm welcome to Benedicta Page of the Trade Journal, the bookseller, to the critic Alex Clark, and to our own Richard Lee. Obviously, this year, Benedict, has started in a terrible way with the killings at Charlie Hebdo in Paris. Michel Houellebecq, who is one of the authors we'll all be looking forward to later in the year, was actually featured on the front cover of the most recent edition of that.
That's right. And in fact, his new book, Soumission, was published the same day as the attacks in France by his publisher Flammarion. I think the connection with him is indirect. He did feature on the cover of this latest issue, but in a very satirical context. I mean, as you would expect, simply poking fun at him and his predictions for the future. But there is no doubt that his latest book is as controversial as ever, and it is on a highly sensitive theme. He has written a book about the future of France. He predicts a 2022 France in which the leader of a new Muslim party has won the presidential election, and there is much fallout thereafter. So you can see why he is in a rather exposed position at the moment. And indeed, it's been an absolutely terrible start to the new year for everyone concerned with free speech and the future of our culture.
Richard, this is obviously going to throw a completely different spotlight on all the books about Islam that will be coming up this year.
Yes, one of which is Patrick Coburn, who I think is a journalist at The Independent, who's written an account of the rise of Islamic State, which I think will be, again, an important book to look at later in the year.
It's just a reminder that this is an issue that has been rumbling on for a very long time, hasn't it? It's become one of the big sort of blocks of publishing interest.
Absolutely. It's slightly unsettling, though, to see Michel Houellebecq, who now appears to be sort of, as it were, on the inside, being attacked by external forces, rather than his rather more usual position of standing outside and turning his fire on what he sees as the establishment.
Mm-hmm. Ben, what about other patterns of the year? I mean, we've already seen anniversaries always tend to have clusters of publishing around them, don't they? And we've already started on the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. The First and Second World Wars will be rumbling on, presumably.
Absolutely. And in fact, this year is the 75th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. And there will be some publishing around that too. One book in particular that I am looking forward to, I don't know if you remember Geoffrey Wellham. He was a fighter pilot in the conflict, and he wrote a book a few years ago called First Light, which was a memoir of his time. And it really was extremely moving. And he will be back this summer with another book, which I think it's called Twilight of the Few. And I think it will also reflect on how being a young man in that conflict affected really the entire rest of the course of his life, as of course it would do.
Mm-hmm. Richard, what about other trends?
Well, we've got an election this year, I think, as we're all looking forward to with very much enthusiasm and excitement. So there's a bunch of election books coming. I mean, I suppose in the week when the Tories launched their campaign with a poster of the German countryside, we should probably start with Sam Delaney's Mad Men and Bad Men, it's a Faber book, which takes an inside look at that relationship, that odd relationship in the UK between advertisers and politicians. So there's the stories about Margaret Thatcher and the Saatchis. There's the demonised campaign of Tony Blair, which I'm sure we all remember. And there's also apparently some, I've not read the book yet, but there's apparently some stories of bad behaviour in Westminster, you know, cocaine, fistfights, champagne, all that stuff. And then in February, there's a couple of books which I think David Cameron will be hoping won't dominate the election. For a start, there's the Professor of Health Policy, Alison Pollock's The End of the NHS, published by Verso. Her subtitle is Why the Government Wants to Destroy the Health Service, which I'm sure David Cameron would disagree with. And she's promising an analysis of how cost-cutting and market forces have brought the NHS to the brink of disaster. We've got ambulances queuing up at A&E and all. So she's returning to the territory where she was at in 2004 when she went through New Labour's confusions over market forces. So perhaps Ed Miliband will be equally quaking in his boots. But I'm sure Ed Miliband will be supporting Polly Toynbee and David Walker, who've got Cameron's coup coming as well. They're from Guardian Faber in February as well, which is about how Cameron's government, which didn't manage to win a majority at all, has proved even more radical than the Tories under Maggie Thatcher. And then in March, I'm quite looking forward to a book from Caroline Lucas, who's the Green MP for Brighton, called Honourable Friends from Portobello. It's a combination of diary and essays about the kind of the bizarre and dysfunctional nature of the British Parliament, just in time for people to kind of vote for her.
That's one of those brilliant, ironic British titles, isn't it? Honourable Friends with a question mark. Exactly. Everything rests on the question mark. Yeah. Alex, you had the enviable task, shall we say, of previewing the year's fiction for The Observer. Tell us what you're looking forward to in terms of novels.
I've had an awful lot to look forward to, actually. And one thing, which I think is accident rather than trend, but nonetheless a rather good accident, is the number of things that could be described as either sequels or sort of companion volumes. And perhaps something that people have really been looking forward to is Kate Atkinson's A God in Ruins. I mean, people went mad, including me, for her book Life After Life, which was this story of a girl whose life simply started again and again and again, and told really the story of England from sort of Edwardian to sort of the end of the Second World War. And this is a companion volume that I understand focuses on her brother, Teddy. But there's also the second volume of Jane Smiley's trilogy, Early Warning, which I'm enormously looking forward to. I loved the first,
We actually interviewed her just before Christmas for this podcast.
It's an amazing project. It's called The Last 100 Years, and it's going to be a trilogy basically chronicling the lives and the sort of tendrils of those lives of one family. And there's also Amitav Ghosh's Flood of Fire, which is the last in his series of books sort of setting in and around Calcutta and the Bay of Bengal. And there's even, Irvine Welsh is even getting in on the act by reprising The Adventures of Juice Terry, one of his favourite characters, in A Decent Ride. But I think moving away from those sort of continuations, they're probably the book that's been most anticipated is Kazuo Ishiguro's Buried Giant, which is a kind of fascinating new direction. I mean, he's not a writer who writes the same book over and over again. Even if there are themes that recur, he enjoys different settings and different challenges. Just think of his book, The Unconsoled, which just suddenly took us to a sort of dreamscape in an unnamed Middle European city. But this takes us back to sort of post-Roman England, when the landscape wasn't even as we knew, and there were ogres and dragons.
You say post-Roman, but I would think of it as post-Arthurian, because it's, in fact, there is one of the Arthurian knights is wandering around on a...
That's right, but the Romans have been. The Romans, there are decaying Roman villas, but there are Saxons and Celts and tribes warring with one another, speaking different languages. And there's also this extraordinary sort of quasi-mystical business of the mist of forgetfulness that has descended over the whole of England, meaning that people can't even recall what's happened in their own lives. Another book that people are really, I suppose it's another kind of exploration of the landscape, is The Wolf Border by Sarah Hall. That's a book that I've heard a lot of good things about, and it's about the reintroduction of wolves in a part of the north of England.
And that's a part of the north of England that borders on Scotland. The border is, and so I think that's fascinating that she's picked the border between England and Scotland just after the referendum, when that's such a live issue, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's also, it's about the scientist who introduces the wolf as part of this project, and she is also unexpectedly and unwelcomely pregnant and having her first child, and so it's a lot about motherhood, and she's also come back to England from a project overseas, so it's also a great deal about reconnecting with her family. It's a very unusual book, actually. I enjoyed it very much.
I'm fascinated, Alex, in the idea of what some people find exciting and other people don't. I mean, Sarah Hall is one of the most promising writers, and she's been sort of gathering strength. What about somebody like Anne Tyler, who's been around for a very long time? We had a debate in the office about whether it was an event, a new Anne Tyler book.
Well, it will be, of course, to her devoted legions of fans, and they are in existence. I mean, one of her most high-profile fans is Nick Hornby, and she has a new book called A Spool of Blue Thread. I don't get the sense that it's a radical departure anyway. You know, it's a story of family, it's a story of place. That place, as it has been for most of her books, is Baltimore. And I think it's an event to her fans. And I guess she is still one of those, like Jane Smiley, one of those American writers, women writers, who get put in a bracket when perhaps that bracket is too constraining for them. They get put in this sort of domesticity bracket. And why is that, we ask ourselves?
Ben, as well as the question of what we'll be reading, there's the question of how we'll be reading it. And is this going to be a year of digital futures? Is everybody going to be buying their third Kindle? Or do you think they're still going to be going to the bookshops?
Well, there's definitely been a big change of pace over the last year. For years, I've been coming here and saying, oh, it's all about digital. But this year, not so much. I say that, but digital is now very established. You know, people who love their Kindle or their e-reader or who are reading on tablets are going to continue doing so. We reckon that last year it was over a quarter of the trade books market. So it's very established. But at the same time, people are not abandoning print, not at all. That market has proved surprisingly resilient. And publishers have also absolutely mastered the art of making their books completely beautiful, objects that you really want to own. There are so many books over the last few months that I have just, you know, clutched to my bosom. You know, books, I don't know if you've seen Michelle Faber's The Book of Strange New Things. It's so
with
gorgeous.
With that sort of beautiful silvery, white and silvery cover.
Yes, and so ethereal.
And it's not anomaly, is it? You do get the feeling that there's been a real push to do that.
Completely, yes.
Mm. Am I really behind the curve? Because I've still got the same e-reader that I got a million years ago, and all it does is read books. That's what it does. It's kind of old-fashioned.
I think you probably
are. Am I missing out?
I think you probably are. Sales of e-readers per se really, really dropped this Christmas. So I think if one's looking to buy a new device, why wouldn't you buy a device where you can do a lot of other things as well, like a tablet perhaps? So,
iPad. I read on my iPad.
I suppose it's because I think if I did that, I would get distracted. I mean, there is a kind of beauty to the thing that's actually clunky and almost sort of most book-like.
That is true.
And they're also fans of e-ink in particular. The experience of reading the black on the grey is very different to reading the glowing screen of a tablet.
Although that is subject of quite a lot of controversy, isn't it, about how much one remembers what one's read electronically. That's possibly the subject for another podcast. And I'm going to ask you all which is the book you are particularly most looking forward to this year, which, of course, you're all going to want to mention 25 books. I'm not going to allow you to mention 25 books. Ben, what are you looking forward to?
Well, in the wish to bring another book into the mix, although I could easily name many of those that have already been mentioned, there is huge expectation around a debut called All Involved by an American writer, Ryan Gatiss, which is coming in May. It's set during the Los Angeles riots of 1992, and it spans the 6 days of the rioting and looks at the events through the eyes of 18 different characters involved, and it is supposed to be extremely
good. I have actually read it.
Have you?
And it's rather like a book form HBO series. It is totally, totally compelling, and I'm sure that it'll be on our television screens shortly. But it is also very literary in its particular way.
Great.
Alex?
Well, call me a bandwagon jumper, but I hadn't heard of this writer, Nell Zink, and now I have, and I think if Jonathan Franzen thinks she's the most extraordinary thing since sliced bread, and there she has been writing her books for non-publication for many, many years, but now her book Mislaid is coming out in July, and I'm really looking forward to that.
Richard?
If you're really, really going to force us to pick just one, then I'm going to say Adam Thirlwell, who's got a novel coming out at the end of this month called Lurid and Cute from Jonathan Cape, which I'm interested in for two reasons. First of all, he published a chunk of it in the Granta Best Young British Novelists edition in 2013. And I enjoyed that immensely. It's just a great voice. It's very lively. It's fun. There's a certain amount of kind of intertextual trickery going on. And it's about a guy who wakes up in a hotel room with everything having sort of gone wrong. And where does he go from there? But also for the reason that when he was last actually in the studio talking about his project Multiples, which was writers translating other writers' work into different languages and what that did to the style, to the prose, Thirlwell said he was actually finding it quite difficult to write himself because he was really wrestling with what it is to have a style. And he was found himself no longer kind of happy to actually just write a sentence in the way that he knew he could write it. He was trying to sort of push the envelope a bit. And I think this book is the result of that. I've read it,
and I really, really enjoyed it. And one of the things, you know, to come in on what you said, one of the things I think he has also said is that it's called lurid and cute because that's not what writing's supposed to be. Writing's not supposed to be lurid or cute. That's what you're supposed to avoid.
He does invite criticism, doesn't he, Adam Thirlwell? Lurid and cute.
Well, it's imaginative and playful. And I suppose that, yes, that often does invite criticism.
And also but just but fiercely intelligent and good fun. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with a bit of that.
There certainly is nothing wrong with that. Well, there's lots to look forward there. If the thought of sheer volume of it makes you feel queasy, then you may be suffering from suffocation. Our next guest, James Wallman, knows all about that. Indeed, it's the title of his timely new book. He came in to talk to Richard.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
So what exactly is suffocation?
Suffocation, it's the feeling you get when you go to your cupboards and you open them up and it's full of stuff, but there's nothing that you actually need. You can't see the clothes that you want to find. We all have toys we don't use. We have kit we don't get round to wearing. Instead of thinking of more the way we used to as a good thing, we think more now means like more to step around, more to store, more to think about, more hassle. More isn't better anymore, it's worse. They call it a clutter crisis, is the way they talk about it. But it's wider, it's much more, as well as a personal problem, it's a social problem, and I think it's a global problem. So I think about stuff as material stuff, and therefore suffocation is the term I use to talk about the problem with materialism, the problem with the value system that drives our culture, the value system that means that we used to look for happiness and identity and status and meaning in material goods, in stuff. And it's the realization that actually all this stuff is bad for us at home, and it's bad for our planet, it's bad for our society, it's making us stressed and depressed and anxious.
Because it's straightforwardly bad for our health. I mean, Darby Sachs found that the people, especially the women who were living with this stuff, who were talking about their homes being cluttered, they actually had raised levels of cortisone.
That was one of the most weird discoveries in my whole research process. When I came across the paper that she'd produced, with a colleague of hers, about how it's not quite raised cortisol levels. It's the way that cortisol is supposed to start high and then dip down quite sharply through the day. And what they found is that people who have issues with their stuff, that, you know, too much to step around and store and the stuff, that too much stuff in their head, thinking about all their stuff, they had this shallow pattern of cortisol dropping off, which meant that they had exactly the same pattern as people that are more likely to be unwell, just more likely to be unhealthy and depressed in all sorts of ways.
It sounds very much like a bit middle-class problem, something for rich Westerners to worry about. How widely applicable is this, do you think, this phenomenon?
I think it's a really good question because it's something that people do talk to me about and say, hold on a second. And I'm really aware that there are millions of people out there who do not have enough. And the message of the book, actually, isn't anti-stuff. It's anti-too much stuff. It's not anti-capitalism or anti-consumerism either, but it's not anti-stuff. It's great to have shoes. If you don't have a pair of shoes, having one or two pairs of shoes is really quite nice. You know, a pair to go to work in, a pair to play in, whatever. But once you've got 10, 15 pairs, it's kind of, you've got enough.
Yeah, we just got to this kind of insane level with it. I mean, the whole thing just sounds totally crazy to any self-respecting Guardian reader. But I mean, how did we get here? Where did it all start with?
It started with the birth of consumerism. You can go back further to, you know, human nature to want to have things around us. But really, the kind of key points was the Industrial Revolution and then the Consumer Revolution. So the Industrial Revolution made it possible to create a lot of stuff in the first place, you know, to take raw materials and churn out things. And then what happened, fascinatingly for me anyway, particularly in the 1910s and 1920s in the States, was there was a realization that all the factories or, you know, industry was producing more than was required for people. And you can look at that in two ways. That's either overproduction or it's underconsumption. And there was a really fascinating debate in the States, you know, about whether the solution was to get people to work less and have more time off, which sounds great to all of us, right? You know, why do 5 days a week when you only need to do 3 days a week? And there was another side, and that was very much the government and a lot of industry that thought the problem wasn't overproduction, it was underconsumption. So the key to balance what was being produced and what could be produced and what people were buying is get people to buy more. So what they did in lots of really clever ways was take thrifty, careful people, which is how we'd always been since the dawn of time, or since we settled down, you know, in the hilly flanks in the kind of in the Middle East and the Tigris and Euphrates, has been the problem of scarcity. How do we get enough to get by? And all of a sudden, there was this sort of this switch around, this problem of having all this stuff that could be produced because of the Industrial Revolution. So what they did was they manipulated, but in a positive way. They encouraged people to, instead of being thrifty and careful, make them become profligate, conspicuous, and wasteful in their consumption.
But it was actually just a plan that was hatched by advertisers, by companies, to buy more than they needed.
Plan is a very strong word. I wouldn't say you know, a bunch of people sat around in a kind of Heidelberg way and said, right, this is what we're going to do. But at the same time, there were smart people saying, okay, here's the problem, how do we solve it? It was the big conversation that was happening in the burgeoning advertising industry. And it was a big problem for industry. How do we solve this problem? What do we do about it? And they solved it in that way, by creating consumers. And then what happened, the magic, was that the standards of living went up in the States.
You quote Herbert Hoover in 1925, giving advertisers the job of creating desire. But I mean, so if there's too much stuff, we're making too much stuff, buying too much stuff, we got too much stuff, why don't we just stop?
It's a great point. And it's something I kind of thought about. You're right. If we've got too much stuff, stop buying it. If we've got too much stuff in our homes, get rid of some. And wouldn't it be great if solving problems were that simple? Wouldn't it be great if solving the obesity epidemic was to tell people, hey, don't eat so much food, do a bit more exercise? And if it was that simple, wouldn't that be what was happening now? But actually, it just isn't that simple. I think human beings, if you know, if you look at behavioral psychology, we don't tend to do necessarily the right thing for ourselves. Even though we know something is better, we don't necessarily follow that. And also, you've got to bear in mind that we are brought up as consumers. We are brought up in a consumer society, and it's so much easier to click on Amazon and buy something than get rid of things. It's actually managing your stuff is hard work, actually. And it's you have that thing where there's something you need and you find you buy it, and it turns out you already had it. I've got to tell you, I don't do that anymore, but that's happened. You know, the first place that people should shop is their wardrobes. I don't know if you saw that statistic in the book that the average woman in the UK has just over 20 items of clothes that she's never worn in her wardrobe.
It's extraordinary. I mean, you tell the story of people who have adopted a lifestyle they call minimalism, where they go through and they get rid of all their stuff, put it in bags and so on. But it's hard work, isn't it?
Oh, I think minimalism, yes, it's hard work. More than hard work, I like having some things. I have shelves of books at home. Minimalism's interesting. It's such a reactionary idea, huge in the States, because I think it's such a driven consumer society, and that's where you'll see the sort of pushback. Yes, it's hard. I think switching the way you see things from having more things to having as few as possible is hard work. But it's a good game to play.
It's almost like putting things into reverse, isn't it? Do you think putting things into reverse is a kind of widespread solution for society, or is that going to be always a minority interest?
I think it'll be minority. I think there's a lovely line in a book by a guy called Bob Cialdini with some others, where he says that the best way to turn a horse is to get on the horse and ride it in the direction it's going. And I think that if you think about the way that our society works, if we were just suddenly stop buying stuff, stop consuming, what's that going to do to our society? I mean, it'd be incredibly damaging. You know, let's take the shoe business, for example, which I talk about in the book. You know, there'd be fewer shoes, fewer people producing leather, fewer adverts to go into newspapers and magazines.
Instant mass unemployment.
Even for journalists. It'd be shocking, a shocking situation. But therefore, I think it's important that people keep spending. I think that's important.
So if we're going to carry on spending, but nevertheless not have stuff falling out of our cupboards and giving us raised levels of cortisone or the wrong cortisone profiles or whatever, then what are we going to do? What's the idea to replace this?
So I spent quite a few years working on this and trying to find the innovators who are living the way that I think points the direction to where we're going next. So the way I came at this was, here's the problem, but also here's how the world is changing. And once I discovered the way the world was changing in a more positive way, I also saw how I could get involved and have an opinion. And I think the way that's going to solve our problem, this problem of stuffocation, is what I call experientialism. Now, it's based on the idea, but the word comes from the idea of materialism. So in the 20th century, the place we looked for happiness, identity, status, and meaning was in material goods, materialism, in stuff. And in the 21st century, I think the way to solve stuffocation is that people find happiness, identity, status, and meaning in experiences instead. So instead of buying another watch or another pair of socks, spending it on having a barbecue with friends, doing something, playing squash with a friend, going for a walk, cycling, whatever it might be, but doing something, not having something.
But still spending. I mean, what's the advantage in doing instead of having?
It's really interesting because there's so much coming out about this, like this big wave of discovery of this idea that experiences give you more happiness than things. It was discovered scientifically. It's one of those things. When I tell this to people, they look at me and say, obviously, we all know that doing things brings us more happiness than having things. But I think that's one of the things about the book. It kind of almost validates what people believe. And it was in 2003 that was like the watershed moment, if you like. These two guys, Lee Van Boven and Tom Gilovich, who are a couple of universities in the States, published a paper called To Do or To Have, That Is the Question. They discovered through 4 or 5 different social science experiments, doing things makes you happier than having things. And since then, psychologists have been trying to work out why. And there's a few different reasons. I mean, the first one is something called hedonic adaptation, which is the idea that we get used to stuff. You know, when you get a new telephone or a new thing comes through the post and you're really excited about it and you push the buttons and you know, show people even in that sort of slightly embarrassing way that we all do. And then 2 weeks later, you don't really notice it. And then a month later, you really don't notice it at all. It's just not quite the same with experiences. We don't get so hedonically adapted. We don't get bored of our experiences in the same way. You can still talk about your holiday to Greece or, you know, the time you went camping and all it did was rain on you. You can still talk about that a year down the line, and in many ways it becomes richer. They give us identity. Experiences give us identity in a way that things just don't. You know, if you had a choice between giving back the toaster that you were bought as a wedding present as opposed to giving back the memory of the stag do, just maybe dinner with friends, or something that you did with your children, would you give back your child's bicycle, or would you give back the time they learned to cycle, or whatever it might be?
So if experiences are better ways of making us happy, rather than spending money on acquiring stuff, we should be spending money on having a good time that we will then remember. By shifting the focus from those things to those experiences, don't you risk just extending the market into areas of life which have been untouched before?
Hey, it's a really good point. And I think there is that concern. There is a concern that if we don't give up consumerism, and the problem is consumerism, not stuff. I don't buy that. Personally, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I think the problem lies with things, not experiences. And yes, the idea of turning every activity we do into an act of consumption is kind of ugly. But at the same time, our society rests on some consumerism. You know, the magic that we have, the good quality of life, the good standards of living that we have rests on people having jobs and therefore people spending money, because that's how the virtuous circle of consumerism and capitalism works. If we don't want to give up all the good stuff, we have to keep some of that. And I think, therefore, I think consumerism is a good thing here to stay. And if we go with experiences rather than material things, there are some dangers. But just by the fact that we're doing things rather than having things, we're going to be happier. The great thing about if you spend money on experiences and time and money on experiences rather than things, you're more likely to be doing those things with people.
I'm wondering how the writing of this book has changed your experience. Have you still got 39 pairs of socks?
No, I've not had a road to Damascus moment. I've not had a kind of, you know, Archimedes in the bath. Whoa, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to completely change. But I've tried out the things and I just don't buy so much stuff anymore. And I'm aware of the things that I have. If I don't use it, what is it doing for me? Apart from being something I have to move from one place to another when I clear up. And it started to really lighten my life, genuinely lighten my life.
James Wallman talking to Richard Lee. Stuffocation is published by Penguin. Thanks to both James and Richard, also to Alex Clark and Benedicta Page. If you have any thoughts about this podcast or any books you'd like to recommend to us, you can do so on the podcast page. If you've come to us through iTunes, you can find it at www.theguardian.com/books/audio. And that's all from us for this week. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Eva Krishak. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.